All right, so welcome everybody. We are doing Parshas Pinchas, and the title of tonight's class is Gandalf the White and Yehoshua, whose connection is clear and obvious. So we're going to start off with, of course, an important scene in the Lord of the Ring movie of Gandalf the White. So without further ado, I'll do a share screen, and we will enjoy the movie. Hope you brought popcorn.
I threw down my enemy and smote his ruin upon the mountainside. Darkness took me, and I strayed out of thought and time. The stars wheeled overhead, and every day was as long as a life age of the earth. But it was not the end. I felt life in me again. I've been sent back until my task is done.
Gandalf.
Yes. That was what they used to call me. Cat of the Grey. That was my name. Gandalf. I am Gandalf the White. And I come back to you now. At the turn of the tide.
All right. There we have it. All right. Obviously, the connection to the Parsha is clear. I think my work is done here. All right. So here we go. Let's get down to the what was Gandalf's status before he was Gandalf the White? This is sort of like getting everybody into the Lord of the Rings orientation.
He was Gandalf the Grey.
He was Gandalf the Grey. What was he? What was his job? What did he do?
He was like the sorcerer of the part of the Fellowship.
Correct. He was a sorcerer. Is he not a sorcerer now?
No, he is. But he's just like reincarnated.
He is reincarnated. Yes, he's reincarnated. Yeah. But he's like a sorcerer plus now. You know, he got an upgrade on the sorcerer. On the sorcerometer, he was now, four, Gandalf the Grey. Now he got moved up, bink, Gandalf
like
the White.
80 in, like, the World of Warcraft or something.
Now, what was it, what made him Gandalf the White?
Because the other sorcerer that was the white version of him was evil, like the guy he mentioned, Saruman?
Yes. And what happened to him?
He was good in the beginning, but then he turned evil. So he was, you know, he was reincarnated as the good version of the White Wizard.
Exactly. So now he's now improved, and he has a new mission, and his mission, of course, is to
help the Fellowship get to the end of their journey.
To help the Fellowship get to the end of their journey. Now, were the people able to see the whiteness of Gandalf? Was his whiteness, his new aura, perceivable to their eyes?
Not immediately, but yeah, eventually, once he let them.
Yes. Yes.
Brian's fine.
Right. In other words, so, and what changed in Gandalf's power from going from gray to white? What was his new power level? You know, using video game, what's his new power level?
it's greater, stronger, I guess.
Right, you saw that he's able to, when they shot three weapons at him, he immediately just negated them in like one fell swoop of his, his staff. Okay?
It's like senior fellowship.
That's like exactly. It's like senior fellowship. It's a perfect example. So the bottom line is his new status is evident in what? His new aura, his new change, correct? In other words, the fact he before was Gandalf the Grey looked like basically a homeless guy with a staff, you know, seemingly a little beleaguered, gray. He looked like a schlepper, using the very precise
kinda
Yiddish term, right? Dirty, gray, you know, rumpled. And now he's come rocking out here. He's got the cool white hair. He has the glow. He's got the cool white glow. He's got the white staff.
Right, so, like Moshe.
Right. So, for example, that. By the way, we had another class. I recommend it, obviously. where we had to compare and contrast to Gandalf to Moshe Rabbeinu. I recommend that's a whole class. We did an hour on that.
I bet most of the fellows.
So go to yutower.org, check out the Gandalf versus Moshe compare and contrast class. It's a good one. All right, we continue. So basically what we want to glean from this is that, this is a little bit of an advanced Lord of the Rings question. What figure in the Western world do people associate Gandalf the White as closely to?
The Pope, Gandhi?
No. But you're in the right direction.
Moses?
Well, that was mentioned by Larry. Good.
Yeah.
Is it easy?
What?
This one?
Jesus, correct. Adrian, correct. You get the Lord of the Rings award. Why? Because remember, he died.
The resurrection.
He resurrected, and he's coming to bring the salvation to the Fellowship of the Ring. So so J.R. Tolkien wrote him either intentionally or unintentionally as a Jesus-like figure who's going to redeem the world. Okay, redeem that world. Okay, so. All right, but the key point is, but his excellence and his newfound powers and his determination of his new mission is manifest in his new white, all-white persona, aura, if you will. Would you all agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we're going to use. We're going to take that. So we're going to borrow that from the Lord of the Rings, and then we're going to now enter into the Parsha. All right, we're going to do a little share screen. All right, if I can ask Shira, you want to read the Psukim?
Sure.
Of course I do.
That's it. Well, you would feel bad if I didn't call on you.
You would. Okay. Moshe spoke to God saying, "Let the omnipotent God of all living souls appoint a man over the community. Let him come and go before them, and let him bring forth and lead them. Let God's community not be like sheep that have no shepherd." God said to Moses, "Take Joshua, son of Nun, a man of spirit, and lay your hands on him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before the entire community, and let them see you commission him. Invest him with some of your splendor so that the entire Israelite community will obey him. Let him stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall seek the decision of the Urim before God on his behalf. By his word, Joshua, along with all the Israelites and the entire community, shall come and go." Moses did as God had ordered him. He took Joshua and had him stand before Eleazar the priest and before the entire community. He then laid his hands on him and commissioned him. It was all done as God had commanded Moshe.
Excellent. Okay, so let me give you some background information here. We're now roughly 40 years into the Jews' journey in the desert. Moshe, in last week's Parsha, was informed, "You're not taking the people in. You're dying here." Right? Good. So Moshe says, rightfully, we should appoint the new leader now, right before I die. Now, first of all, the question is, why did he wait? Why did he want Yeshua to be appointed now while he's still alive? And this goes into, this is a general idea, but a basic idea. Say it again, Elise.
I was saying so he can learn from him. It's kind of like if you're replacing someone at a job and there's like a week of overlap, so you could, you know, shadow them. They could mentor you.
Yes. So this first idea is that if, let's call it, in every executive, and not only in the executive, but in any good company, it is very common for, let's say, a person's going to move on to a new position, to have a week or 2 weeks or even a month of overlap so they can show them the ropes, if you will, and show them who, you know, how things operate. So just to pass on the knowledge of how to do that role, how that position should do. Excellent point. Anybody want to add to that?
I think that you have another situation going on here.
Go ahead, Marvin.
People are like, they're not very cooperative. They don't listen to their leaders. They do mutinies, all this other kind of stuff. If you just have somebody who says, "Hey, I'm the boss now after Moshe dies," you're going to have about 50 other people saying, "No, I'm the leader."
Okay. Excellent point, Marvin.
Now I'm going to come in. Instead of 50 other people, we'll hone it down. The people that would feel the rights based on their scholarship or the family or the relatives, like we said by Korah.
Well, yeah, but Marvin, so that you're just supporting Marvin's point. In other words,
I'm supporting Marvin, but I'm bringing it instead of 50, Let's bring it down to 3 to 5.
Okay, fine. So whether it be 3 to 5 contenders or 50 contenders, but the bottom line is the book of Bamidbar, which we're in here, has been a story of one disaster of the other. We have a Korach rebellion. We have Dutton Vaviram, who are also part of the coalition, who are the mutinous coalition. So it's very important that there's a clear and coherent transfer of power. And it's done with Moshe agreeing, and clearly that Hashem is agreeing. And in fact, we do see that nobody, and that change of, the changing of the guard, if you will, was never contested. So this was actually a successful changing of the role. Adrian?
A quick side question. Why is Moses going to God and not God going to Moses?
That's an excellent point. Why did Moshe bring this up? Why didn't God tell Moshe? Excellent. In other words, if this is such an obvious point, if this is such a critical point, why didn't God tell Moshe, Moshe, yay, you're not going to be around that long, and you know, it's not time to be buying the green bananas, so why don't we take care of the transition of power now before there's a problem? But one answer off the top, I think it's a good question. I'm not sure if it fully answers your question, Adrian, but it really shows you the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. What do I mean by that? Most people, anybody who's involved with family-run businesses, one of the biggest challenges of family-run businesses is the change of authority, even within the family, much less from one person to another. So what happens is, it's oftentimes a disaster. The old geezer does not want to leave control. He's like 97 years old, coming into the office at 7 o'clock in the morning, driving everybody crazy. And meanwhile, his children are like in their 60s. You know, they're kept in under muzzle to do with their job. And since there is no clear succession, oftentimes businesses have been literally ripped apart because there was no clear succession planning. And there was tremendous amounts of fighting. But Moshe, instinctively, he's not about the glory. He cares about the Jewish people. So immediately, once he's told he's not continuing as the leader, he immediately asks God, let's have a succession right now. It's a measurement of God. I don't know if that fully answers your question fully, but it clearly is a compliment to Moshe, because most people, when they're in charge, as you see, how many presidents, unless they can't, if they're given one term, don't want to run for a second term. Once they got the power, once they got, you know, Air Force One, once they're in the White House, they tend not to leave. So there has to be the thing called term limits. Otherwise, there would not be any limits. It would be a monarchy.
There's a show called Succession, which describes exactly what you just said. Like an HBO show, I believe, called Succession.
Right, Succession. Right. This is an ancient thing. I'm familiar with, in New York, just to give you guys a little... there's many of the real estate holdings of apartment buildings are owned by Jewish families. You know, it's like their grandfather had it start off with one tenement building in 1905, and then they built it up. And then meanwhile now, you know, four generations later, you know, they have like 15,000 apartments under their control. So many Jews like that in New York City. So, and how these things are dealt with is messy. Moshe wanted to avoid the messiness. We're doing it now. Okay. Now, what other questions do we have here in regards to how did God plan or instruct Moshe how to run the succession ceremony? Take a look at the ceremony. All right.
Can you review it, please? Just summarize it for us?
Yeah, I'll summarize it. So he says, he says, gather all the people. So the Jewish, all the Jewish people are gathering around. You got Yoshua. You have the high priest now, because in last week's Parsha, Aaron the high priest died. His son, Eliezer, succeeded him. He will be dressed in full regalia, okay? And basically, the Jewish people are told there's going to be a checks and balances of power. There's two power here. It is true that Yeshua will be the leader, but whether or not to go out is going to become via the there's the breastplate, the Urim Vetumim. Have you guys seen the Kohen Gadol has a 12 stone breastplate? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it represents all the tribes.
Right, each stone, each one of the stones represents one of the 12 tribes. Exactly. So when he'd wear that, and he would get sort of a prophetic insight, and because the leader, Yeshua, would ask him, should we attack the city in this way? And via the vehicle of the Urim Vetumim, he would gain this divine inspiration and be told what to do. So in a certain sense, Yeshua can't act autonomously. It's being done via a prophetic insight. So Eliezer, the Kohen, works in concert. It's a two-part role. Now, not to mention, the people who are there includes the Sanhedrin. So it's the third party. So we have the judicial, we have the priest, Kohen Gadol, and we have the leader, the Melech, the de facto king, and that's Yeshua. So basically, the Jewish people are presented the new governmental system, and they're told, now, what is Moshe told to do? He's told, put your hand on him. Now, by the way, putting the hand on is the word smicha. You guys heard the word smicha? Oh, that guy, he has smicha. Do you heard that before?
Rabbinical ordination.
Rabbinical ordination is correct. So rabbinical ordination becomes a way of demonstrating that you're now a musmach. You've now been ordained. You've been chosen as capable of, making the appropriate Jewish and legal decisions. You're now a musmach. So he's told to put his hand on his head in front of everybody and told that he's going to be the guy. All right, and what does Moshe do? He did it. He got everybody together. He got Eliezer. He did it. Boom. Now Yeshua's the leader. Okay. Let's now go to, we'll start off with a Midrash. Okay. Let's have Shmuel in Kansas City, Missouri. It was great to see you at the wedding. I'm Mick Malzduff.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
I wouldn't have missed it. Go ahead.
What was that?
I wouldn't have missed it. Go ahead.
The Midrash says, quote, that all of the congregation of the children of Israel should be obedient to him.
Go on.
That they should comport themselves toward him with respect and reverence in the same way as they comport themselves towards you.
Ah, this is another dimension. It's similar to what Marvin brought up, but slightly different. Why are they doing it now? Why this grandiose presentation? What problem is it solving?
Legitimacy,
and that they should respect. That he should be invested with the same authority and respect as Moshe, because that's why Moshe is doing this phenomena. This process of inducting him in as the leader of the Jewish people before them, and now they say, oh, he's the guy. So they'll treat him as not just one of Moshe's students, but rather as Moshe's successor. And going back to Marvin's point, and since Jews have a problem with authority, it's funny. We have this, there is a paradox here, guys. We have a system which Hashem is our king, and we have to listen to commandments. So we have a lot of authority. But who are the people who have the biggest problem with authority? It seems to me it's Jews.
we got
comport. In other words, the fact that we have to respect God's authority, that's already, we're already at the limit at that, and therefore to respect anybody else for any amount of time for anything is just annoying. So.
Not wearing masks. I see it all the time in Munsee when I go there.
It's one of my pet peeves. You don't get it, Marvin. Don't even get me started. So, anyways, So the point being is that's a separate aside. I'm not saying that's just my own observation. I don't know if it's true, but you can be your own judge of that. Now,
I went into the store last week. There was almost nobody wearing masks in a very crowded store on a Thursday night.
Right. Marvin, you're pressing on my buttons here. I'm gonna stay on the class here. Okay. I'm not taking the bait. Good try there, but we're not doing it. All right, let's go to the Sforno. Marvin, read the Sforno, Marvin.
Okay. My Hebrew without the vowel.
All right. So v'natata mehorcha alav, and you shall grant from your glory unto him. I Yeshua. Go on.
You will confer upon him some of the robe, your regal authority, while you are still alive, so the people will get into the habit of treating him with respect.
Notice, get into the habit of treating him with respect. But what do you see from that? That naturally...
No respect.
No respect. All right. Go on. Laban Yishmu, in order to listen. Go on.
The reason why you are to appoint him in full view of the people is so that the whole Edah... i.e. the Supreme Court, the leaders of the nation, will get into the habit of listening to what he has to say with reverence.
Exactly. So very similar to what the Midrash is saying, that the Jews are having a whole problem with authority and respecting and listening, and that problem has not gone away. And therefore, Moshe wisely, and Hashem did listen to him, we need to do the succession early. Now, by the way, Bo, this is at the end of Bamidbar. We have another book to go, where Yeshua is like on the on deck circle. Okay, but still, it takes Jews time to get used to a new guy in town. All right,
Rabbi.
Yes.
I thought the Jewish law was down here for us to decide, and not up there for God to decide, and taking away power from the Supreme Court and investing it in the executive branch. That seems to be in contradiction with that Talmudic passage and our common understanding of separation of powers as well.
You are correct. This is the end. In other words, Moshe still, when he has a halachic problem, will confer with God. In fact, right before this, we have the story of the daughters of Tzlachad, whose father died, had no sons, and they say, hey, we also want to get land. Why shouldn't the land go to us based upon the laws of inheritance? Moshe says to the women, good point, I'll be back, confers with God, and says, yeah, if there are no sons, you get the land. So this is the last, but once Moshe's gone, it's now, Jewish law is no longer... prophecy is over for Jewish law, and now it's Moshe, it's Joshua working with the Sanhedrin, working out the law themselves based upon the principles of the oral law. Okay, but this is the tail end of it. Excellent point, Adrian. We're rocking.
Side question.
Side question. We love side questions.
How did the Jews view Yeshua since the Meraglim episode, and like where is he in before this? Where is he considered now?
That's an excellent point. We don't have any like common or they when, you know, 38 years earlier, they didn't listen to them. They were throwing stones at them because they were the two spies that brought back a positive report. They didn't like that. They're about to murder them, literally, not figuratively, actually, if God did not intervene. So now 38 years later, most of the people died off. This is a new generation. It's the kids of that generation. So I don't know. We don't have a journalistic sidebar, you know, like a little poll. What's your feelings about who's pro Yeshua? It's about 78%. Who doesn't like that? I don't care from that much. And 5% undecided.
I forgot it was 30 something years. It was only a few parts ago, but
right,
but
really, right. There's last week there was a quiet 38 year jump, which is very interesting. The Torah does not record much of anything after the decree of the spies. 38 years later, then we have everything starts. You know, Miriam dies, Aaron dies, the famous incident with the rock, and Moshe's basically told you're not going in. And now we're at this. You know, Eleazar takes over for Aaron. Yoshua's taking over for Moshe. Generation leaving, new generation starting. So, all right.
And why couldn't they go to Israel right away?
That was a punishment because of the sin of the spies. That's exactly it. And if you want to know more about that, see all my classes on the sin of the spies. Available at yutorah.org. Shameless plug. That's it. I can't answer all the questions of the Parsha every time. This is our fifth or sixth go around. So all right. Now, let's get into, now I'm going to bring into our whole experience of Gandalf, because Rashi brings a wild comment. All right, Bavakasha. All right, Shmuel, finish this off. Do the Rashi's answer. When he says you should put some glory upon him, go on.
So are we at question two? Why would it be difficult?
No, we already answered. We answered those questions.
And you shall put some of your glory upon him. This refers to the shining of the skin of his countenance.
Okay, I don't know if you guys remember this, but if you didn't, don't worry about it. I've already given you the information. This goes back to Pasha's Ki Tisa. When Moshe Rabbeinu comes down from receiving his 40 days up on Mount Sinai, receiving the Torah, he comes down, and let's read about that. I'm going to pick it up. Let's have Suzanne read it out with gusto.
Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. As Moses descended from the mountain, he did not realize that the skin of his face had become luminous when God had spoken to him. When Aaron and all the Israelites saw that the skin of Moses' face was shining with a brilliant light, they were afraid to come close to him. Moses summoned them, and when Aaron and all the community leaders returned to him, Moses spoke to them. After that, all the Israelites approached, and Moses gave them instructions regarding all that God had told him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking with them, he placed a hood over his face. Whenever Moses came before God to speak with him, he would remove the hood until he was ready to leave. He would then go out and speak to the Israelites, telling them what he had been commanded. The Israelites would see that the skin of Moses' face was glowing brilliantly. Moses would then replace the hood over his face until he would once again speak with God.
Okay, so here we have an example, seemingly like Moshe becomes Gandalf-esque. Before he was Moshe the Gray, and now he's Moshe the White. He comes back from Har Sinai, bing! He's shining like a menorah over there. And it's too intense for the people. And when he shares the Torah with them, they see that. And when he's done, he puts on a hood, you know, just like, you know, in the Jedi hood. So he's covered up. So, I mean, so what's going on there? So let's get to some questions here.
Rabbi, didn't he have it when he was born also?
That's midrashically that he had. There was special light. Good call. All right, we're going to get into this. All right, but we're not done with another Rashi. Go ahead, another Rashi, go on.
Oh, some of thy glory and not all thy glory. Consequently, we learn from this. Moses' face beamed like the sun. Joshua's face only like the moon.
Ah, okay, so fine. So I'm going to make this a little bit bigger. I don't know what happened here. All right, let's go to some questions here. All right, question number one. What does Rashi add to the explanation of the Midrash and Sforno?
That even when Joshua takes over, Moses is still always going to be a grander figure in history.
That's certainly true. True. What else?
That Moshe has direct light, like the sun and the moon, is just a reflection and absorbs and shines the reflection, not the real thing.
Correct. Obviously, a limited point. But what? But the Midrash and the Sforno, if you had to, what was their focus of the succession plan or the succession ceremony? What's the main goal?
The people's acceptance.
Right. For people to recognize that Yeshua is the legitimate, honorable, leader of the Jewish people, and that's what Moshe's doing. But Rashi is bringing down, there's another dimension to this story that he's sort of giving him some of his, quote unquote, some of his light. Okay? Now here's the question. Does Rashi view Yoshua as being similar to Gandalf?
she knew who Gandalf was.
But I mean, okay, it's true, but in the same sense that he's becoming lit up.
But maybe Gandalf, or is Gandalf more like Moshe?
Well, all right, so the Moshe story, but okay, so that's another good analogy. Is Rashi showing us that in a different order, because they're working on the word hod. Hod, the word hod, could mean honor or glory. It's a term that's a synonym. So the hod could be referred to the Hebrew of the light is called the Karen Or, the beam of light that's coming from his face, the Karen Or. So he's saying that hod refers to the Karen Or, the beam of light. So the question is he basically saying that there's now this magical aura that's surrounding Yoshua? Now, does the Torah tell us that? When he does that, is there any mentioning of when, going to scroll back, when Moshe did this, does it say that Yoshua became beaming?
No.
So that would suggest that means it doesn't mean it in the same sense. Now, the first question we have to ask is, what really... which is really question number three. What is the beaming of Moshe's face connected to his learning of Torah from Hashem? What does that mean? What idea is being expressed there?
Isn't that like when he learned the Torah directly, that some of the light from Hashem passed directly into Moshe because he took wisdom directly from Hashem as opposed to being passed through someone else?
Exactly. Excellent point. In other words, the light represented sort of the purity and the sort of special quality of the wisdom that Moshe as the Adon HaNavim, the master of all prophets, received from Sinai. So one could argue that when he came down, this is an idea I heard from one of my teachers, Rabbi Fox, is that a miracle was made that when he came down, that people sensed that what Moshe was telling them was really what? Was from Hashem, was qualitatively different, and that really that he wasn't sharing something which was really from his own imagination.
Rabbi, looking at this in a more metaphorical lens,
yes,
maybe what the light represents is this wisdom, because when you learn something, it's as though you're in the dark before, and now that you know something, it's as though you're in the light, because you know what to confront it.
Excellent. Adrian, excellent point. There is a debate among the commentators back in Shemot. Is this light a physical light, you know, which was created to communicate to the people about this great insight that Moshe had and he's sharing? Or as what Adrian is saying, it's really a metaphor. But the bottom line is, but the core idea is the same. It's reflective of the light, as Shira said so elegantly, that it's a light that Moshe captured during his stay up at Mount Sinai. And they were able to perceive that. They saw that Moshe, he's not the same guy. And what he's saying is completely, they sense the profundity of it, the depth of it, and therefore they were moved by that. Now, why did Moshe have to cover his face at all times except when he taught Torah?
It depends if we're going with the metaphor or the literal.
Okay. Give me either one. Take it either way.
Well, I got one explanation for the metaphor. Is that you only want to use your light, the light of your wisdom, for a positive purpose and not for a negative purpose, like building a nuclear bomb that's going to decimate a whole city.
Okay, so what does the fact that he's going around, as somebody said before, with a Jedi robe cover, except when there, unless it's time for the, until it's time for the, let's call it the very first Parsha class, where he's going to take off the robe and give the class to the people. What impact does it make on the people?
If it's the impact on the people is knowing that this heavenly wisdom is only to be applied for positive purpose, only for teaching, for transmitting positive values, and that's why if we're looking at this as purely as a metaphor, the life being wisdom, its application is only in teaching positive values to people, not in building atomic bombs.
Well, I think, I'm not sure that Moshe is on the edge of becoming a Sith Lord using in other words,
the Pusik says straight out they're scared.
They are scared, correct. But question is, are they scared, according to the non-literal approach, they're scared because they sense that, in other words, it's an experience of intimidation. They feel that Moshe is like, he's not a scary guy in that they feel he's going to beat them. He's, but it's there's sort of a tremendous sort of reverence for him that it's like a little bit, it's like he's too intense. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's the same fear they felt the first time, like when he started saying the Ten Commandments out loud, like the people couldn't take.
Right, that's when they heard it from Hashem. Right, exactly. In other words, there's a fear of a sense of reality and of clarity that they can't handle. So they can only handle that in what? Short, limited times.
Maybe not fear, more awe.
Awe is a better, that's a better word. Awe is a better word. Good word choice, awe. All right, let's continue. So basically, Moshe's covering, because he's all about the Torah, and when he's not sharing, he's involved in thinking about that. He's in his own world, and when he's sharing it, he's completely committed to one focus. Okay.
Could it also be the beginning of, snoot, maybe?
Well, in other words, insofar as that he's not showing off, you mean?
Yeah, like he's personally, he's keeping himself composed and private.
And hidden.
And he's not like exposing himself unless it's for the purpose of teaching Torah.
That's another good thought. That's, in other words, the idea that, is that he's not, in other words, right now, he's not about.
Under the robe?
Say it again?
He's wearing more than underwear under the robe?
I can't hear you.
He's wearing more than underwear under the robe, or just underwear?
I assume he's fully, fully dressed. Whatever that was, fully dressed was in the time of the Torah. But the point being that basically he's focusing entirely on what he's thinking about, and he's not using his position and getting any satisfaction of being basically the leader of the Jewish people, which of course can be a very egotistical experience. He basically withdrawing. He's just thinking about that special light of insight that he has gained from Sinai, from God. And when he shares it, and then he's withdrawing back. Now, using that, let's see if we can understand the analogy to learning implied by Moshe's knowledge being a sun and Yeshua is a moon. What does that mean?
Well, the moon receives its light from the sun. So the moon is sort of more of a humble. So the moon needs to be humble in order to shine its light. It needs to be sort of translucent.
Where does the sun, where does the moon get its light from?
Could you say that Moshe was a direct representation of, or source of that light through Hashem, and whereas Yeshua was simply a reflection of that?
Exactly. That's exactly what I would say, Shmuel. Excellent. What was, it's not mentioned here, what was the key characteristic that the Psukim talk about Yeshua in another part of the Torah? I don't know if you guys heard this part. What was Yeshua's claim to fame? We know about it being one of the 12 spies, came back with a positive report. It says he never left Moshe's tent. He was his assistant. He was basically his student. And basically he dedicated himself to not just learning, but living with Moshe. So basically he absorbed Just a comment that Rabbi Soloveitchik said on this very point is that there are two kinds of learning you get from your teachers of Torah. One is the formal, direct, intellectual component of the Torah, the ideas, the concepts, the principles. And then there is the nonverbal, experiential learning. In other words, how did Moshe Rabbeinu, as it were, do an act of kindness, an act of charity? What was it like to see Moshe daven? Not to learn about davening, but to see him daven. So a person who has that, not just the formal component, but the informal component, sees the Torah becomes alive in a qualitatively different way. And the Talmud goes as far as saying the following, Gadol Shimusho Milimudo, that greater is the service of the Torah teacher than the actual formal education. And the learner from Elisha, the prophet, was washing Eliyahu, the prophet, his teacher, his hands. So you see that in a certain sense that the Talmud venerates. The fact is just the day-to-day engaging and helping, because it gives you moments to see sort of their quiet world of how does this person conduct themselves in their service of God in private when nobody's looking. And you sort of get the non-verbal lessons of, you sort of learn moments of goodness outside the study hall, outside the classroom. And Yeshua was a person who, so he got everything. He had the profound ideas of Moshe to a very great degree. And he got these other components as well, the personal experiences. He never left his tent. So now we get to the moment here of how God, as it says, Rashi says, he granted him glory of his face. So it doesn't mean that he became a shiny person, but the essence of that idea was that in one moment, he was able to share something with Yeshua that took him over the next line. Now, there's sometimes you can learn something in a very short amount of time that will change your entire paradigm. Okay? And I'm going to share a story there was a guy, Franz Rosenzweig, those who were my senior fellowship class, we spoke about this at the beginning of the year in running up to Yom Kippur. But for those who are not in this current year's senior fellowship, let me tell you the story again. Franz Rosenzweig was an assimilated German Jew. He went to university. And he met another assimilated Jew who converted to Christianity.
Whoa.
And the guy said, he says, Franz, you're a hypocrite. You dress like a German Christian. You eat like a German Christian. You get the same education as a German Christian. Why don't you just man up and be honest and convert and become a full German Christian? This is around 1913, 1910. You're living a lie. You're living in every way. You're a German Christian. Yeah, you're holding on for some idiosyncratic craziness. You want to keep being a Jew. But there's nothing about you that's a Jew. He called him out on it. He said, why don't you convert? Be consistent. So the story goes that Franz Rosenzweig, before he did that, he said he wanted to spend a Yom Kippur in a German, an Orthodox synagogue. Wasn't Orthodox, himself not Orthodox, not observant at anything. Zero observance. And he doesn't talk about precisely what occurred at what point during that day, other than that something happened during that day, that shofar blast at the end, whatever it was, it's something very personal, he never revealed that. But at that point, he became committed to being a Jew, And not only is he going to become just a Jew, but he wanted to become a educated Jew. And he had no Jewish education. And he's an adult. He already had like a degree from the university already. And he was, since he's a brilliant person, went on a study and he became observant. And he wrote books of philosophy that were regarded not just Jews, but non-Jews as well. And there's something happened on the Yom Kippur. And he doesn't tell you exactly what happened, but his whole world changed. That's a 25-hour period of time, a short amount of time. And of that half year in shul, there's something happened there. He heard a shofar that year. Everybody else in that shul heard that shofar, but they were not changed. They said, great, now we can go eat. He heard that shofar. Something deep inside him transformed. And the bottom line is, there could be moments in our lives that could be a very short moment where you get a certain insight that literally can change your paradigm and the direction of your life. So what Rashi's suggesting is that when Moshe put his hands onto Yoshua and had this public demonstration of succession, it wasn't only he's now the leader of the government. He's now the leader of the Jewish people. He could have shared some wisdom, enough element, just a few things, insights. When you deal with very abstract, a few thoughts, a whisper in his ear that can made him, in a certain sense, also partake of the light, the Karen Or. That light that Moshe had, although it wasn't the same extent, Moshe's the sun, Yoshua was the moon, but still he became illuminated to a greater, it further accelerated his education that he'd been having with Moshe for the last 40 years. And that really is the point. So in contrast to the movie where we have the Lord of the Rings, that Gandalf is transformed as this Jesus figure who's now all white and is there to redeem the fellowship. Moshe also gives, quote-unquote, midrashically, the light to Yoshua, but that light is an insight that allows him to lead the people in a qualitatively different way. And it's no evidence from the verses that the people saw that change. They saw him as being, we have to have awe, we have to have reverence, he's the leader, we're not going to question his authority, we're not going to question his legitimacy. But what the Rashi is pointing out, the Midrash says, Moshe did was like pouring from one vessel to another. There was a couple of drops of wisdom that could change your life. Now for Franz Rosenzweig sitting in that small shul in 1913, it was a shofar blast that changed his life and his trajectory and the trajectory of his family and all of his students, because he was a well-regarded philosopher. And that really is what we're looking for. We're always looking for the moment, the insight that could move us out of our comfort zone into a place of a deep appreciation of the things that we have and the direction we should go in life. Yes, questions? Adrian.
It's not a small question, but I feel I need to speak my mind and not hold it forevermore. I've been reading Thomas Paine's Common Sense article.
Okay.
That's sort of what instigated the American Revolution.
Yes.
Interestingly, Thomas Paine references the Jews asking for a king and sort of God's reaction to that and how they suffered miserably. And that was one of his main attacks on the British crown.
Yes.
It was so oppressive of the colonies in America.
Yes.
And when I'm reading this, this text, and I very much like the insight analogy about how an insight can completely change the trajectory in your life, and I completely wholeheartedly agree with that. But when it comes to authority, and authority being delegated by, some holiness, you know, whether that's some like magical thing that happens, that you put your hand on someone and now they have absolute authority because it sort of comes from God. That's how kings throughout history have remained in power. That's why kings have crosses on their crowns.
Correct. So let me speak to that. You're bringing up a lot of good points here. So was Yeshua a king?
He was king-like.
He was, but again, he's authority, but there is no king until King Saul, which is going to be for another, 400 years. So he's not a king, and already there is, there's only, in Judaism, there's never a king, in a certain sense. There's only one king. It's Hashem. And the distinction is, and this is one of the classic distinctions between the Torah and other Near East texts, such as Hammurabi, which was also extant in the time of the Torah. The Torah, whether you're the person who's the manhig, the leader, or you're a person who is shepherding, or you're gathering water, or whoever your job is, you're all under the authority of Hashem. In other words, in Hammurabi, there's a Hammurabi code for the people, but the prince, he is above the law. In Judaism, there is nobody above the law. Now, you're right. What Thomas Paine recognized, the same conversation of what Samuel had with the people. Your interest of having a king really is, you don't really like Hashem. You want to be able to have a guy that you can really control and be like everybody else. So there was a tremendous criticism for that. But Yeshua is not a tyrannical king. And already the key point is that what Judaism brought to the world is the idea of the separation of powers. You have the Sanhedrin, the judicial. You have the monarchy, and then you have the Kohen / the Navi, and he can't even go to war without getting everybody on board on that. So he doesn't have infinite powers.
That's the reason Moses.
So there's two layers. So what I'm sharing with you tonight, there's two layers. That's to be understood on two levels. On the plain pshat, he's demonstrating that I'm now transferring my authority to Yeshua. Yeshua, he's the man. Or put in modern times, you got a problem, go speak to him. Okay? All right? The buck stops over there. Okay? Or in very short order, as Elise brought out before, there's going to be a time of sort of the showing of the ropes, and then I'm throwing him the keys. He's taking you over the other side of the Jordan. I'm staying here. Bye-bye. Okay? So that's the pshat. The pshat level is a transference of authority, a succession plan. That's level one. Rashi brings a midrash that shares you the deeper idea here. That not only was this the hands giving of the hod, because hod has a... We say that in the Tehillim, Hod v'har levashta, God is clothed, as it were, metaphorically, with glory and splendor. So it bespeaks of what Shir was talking about before, some of the light that Moshe was able to apprehend at Mount Sinai, he gave that to Yeshua. Obviously, it didn't happen a zap only at that moment. Yeshua was studying with him for 40 years. But you could even have, what I'm sharing is that there could be a mentioning of something, an insight. For example, when the Torah talks about the secrets of the Torah, it's only communicated through hints. So sometimes you can get a hint, which is very short, which can have a very profound impact. And the impact on a person does not take years and years of study. And that's why I brought the example of Franz Rosenzweig, who had just spent one Yom Kippur. And we don't even know how long he was even in the shul. You know, I may have been there, not the whole time. But whatever it was, it changed his life. And I want to tell you, being an MG for the last 13, 14 years, many people tell me that they had their own moment. And it's never everything. Some people was Yom Kippur. Some people was a Shabbaton. Some people it was this. Some people it was that. Everybody had a certain moments. And it wasn't quantitatively that long. It wasn't 75 hours. It could have been just a certain experience. Could have been, we were at the wall. It was Friday night. We were overlooking the Kotel. And that was a Shabbos that they just, that was like, that for them was just simply amazing, transformational, really lifted them. You know what I mean? And really made a big difference for them. And it's something they reference back to as sort of a guiding experience for years later. So it wasn't that long. How long was it? 2 hours? 3 hours? And within that, it was maybe a couple of minutes. So my point being is that you can have an impactful moment, which is very short, very condensed. An intellectual way could be just a whisper of a few thoughts. An experiential could be a very short experience. And really anybody, for all you guys that have been part of the MG community over the years, you know either of yourself or others who at various points had a moment that changed the relationship for Judaism forever. And they'll go back to that. And they'll think about that. And they'll, at the very least, they'll always think about that in a very warm way. Because it really, it was very meaningful to them at the time and something they go back to. And it wasn't 75 hours. It could have been literally, in actual mathematical time, it could have been like 3 minutes. But it wasn't 3 minutes in psychological time. It was very impactful. So that's what Rashi is giving you, a sort of a next layer of understanding. We look at the Torah like a geologist. There's things happening on the surface, and then we go to the next layer, and the next layer, and we unpack it, step by step, level by level. And that's
what we got through Kabbalah.
That's a little bit above my pay grade. I can only take you down so deep, my friend. At that point down, I'll pass the baton to somebody else. All right, guys.
Okay,
last question. Go ahead.
Not so deep, but so from here we could actually, maybe you could say over the last 30, 40 years, there are a lot of little moments that built up to that. Not
yes.
Maybe one moment like a yes. Right situation.
Yes, correct. In other words, it's a culmination of a 40-year relationship, a learning relationship. And Moshe knows exactly where Yeshua's at, so sharing a special moment, an idea with him, he knows what he needs at that particular point.
Like Rabbi Pinney, just you saying what you said about moments at MJE,
yes.
I had about, between my Israel trip, and I only did one. People here, I'm sure did too, right? Between the Israel trip, winter, summer retreats, schmoozing with you one-on-one about certain things I didn't want to talk to you about.
Okay.
But I managed to muster my courage up. I could say that, and even downtown, a bunch of moments came already. I could almost write a little book. So
okay.
You.
All right. So, I know everybody here has, I know of some of your moments. I may know some of your moments that, because first of all, I may have been there to experience them with you. I may have been. In Israel. Israel is like, you know, is like these, the trips are always filled with these kind of moments. Very impactful. And that's all, that's why we go when we try to, you know, you feel, that's when you come after the Israel trip, you feel exhausted because it may have only been 7 days, but you feel like you've been there for a month.
Like, 7 days, 2 hours of sleep.
I stayed two weeks later and committed to senior fellowship afterwards. That's it. Because you're up all night planning everything, planning the buses.
Yeah.
Hey, we had to wake up at 7 a.m. to daven. Yes.
That's not my favorite part. That's not my favorite part.
We partied on that Thursday night and we went to Sega at the coast.
I was there for that.
We had the liquid Kavana,
aka coffee.
A lot of that just to get a stir.
Unbelievable.
I was there
Remember, I leaned for Glenn's bar mitzvah.
I remember that.
I think it was actually Parshas Pinchas.
It could very well have been. It could have been. I remember that. And
it was. It's my bar mitzvah question. It was either Parshas Pinchas or Rosh Chodesh.
I remember that. That was a special moment. Glenn had his bar mitzvah at the Kotel. Like, you know, hey, I've never been bar mitzvah. Never had a leader. All right, we'll do it now. Boom.
At 46.
Okay. I love that. I always love that. Boom, we'll do it now. I just love that. That's you know, as they say, that's gold.
It's gold. That was great.
All right, guys. All the best. Take care.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Bye.